Greetings to the crew of the Gaian Navigation Experiment and all others who may find the material of this recording to be of interest. This is John Lasher, Navigator, recording on the 18th of March, 2014. And I will be reading an essay from metahistory.org in the category of 2012 Shift. The essay entitled The Tablet of Destiny, Omens in the Skywriting for 2012. I'm offering this reading to accompany the written material, as some of you may prefer to listen rather than read. The relevance of this material will be self-evident. It relates closely to some points in Nav Briefing number 116, on the omen of war. As I proceed with this reading, I may from time to time add a little bit of commentary if something comes to mind. When I do so, I will indicate an added note. The Tablet of Destiny. This series of essays began with a consideration of how the timing of Kali Yuga, calculated in the sacred chronology of the Hindus, might tally with Maya Aztec calendar, especially the 2012 end time. I pointed out that the lesser Kali Yuga that began in 3102 BCE is contiguous with the start of the Maya long count. The length of the lesser Kali Yuga is one-fifth of the full precessional cycle, or kalpa. 72 degrees of precession at 1 degree every 72 years equals 5,184 years. This figure closely matches the average duration of the five Aztec suns and the Maya period of 13 baktuns of 144,000 days each. To the Maya-Hindu-Aztec correlation, I then added the Egyptian factor, encoded on the Dendera zodiac by axis D through Antares, also dated closely to 3102 BCE. The present longitude of Antares, the red-gold giant in the heart of the scorpion, is 249.76 ecliptic longitude, or 69.76 degrees removed from the fall equinox. Using the mean rate of 72 years per degree of precession, 69.76 degrees converts to 5,023 years, and this figure, less 2,000, gives 3023 BCE, pretty close to 3102. We have seen how cosmic timing can be indicated not only by the vernal equinox, VP, but by other arms of the actual axial cross as well. When the autumnal equinox coincided with Antares around 3023 BCE, Kali Yuga began. At that moment, the spring equinox coincided with Aldebaran in the Eye of the Bull, exactly, or nearly exactly, opposite to Antares. I have suggested that the Antares-Aldebaran axis defines the formal structure of the zodiac. The alignment of precessional timing to this axis is a strong signal that highlights the moment of entry into the lesser Kali Yuga. The spirit star in the brilliant composite of Mother Scorpion signals our entry into a 5,000-year period that now, as it draws to a close, is taking us straight into an extinction event. Aztecs are us? But all the news from the Scorpion is not bad news. This evening, and for some evenings lately, I have been observing the Scorpion and the Archer from an ideal sky-viewing zone in southern Europe. From midnight into the wee hours of the morning, I see the scorpion composite down to the full extension of its massive tail hook, cartwheeling left to right over the rugged mountains of Africa. With this view, I can confirm an observation made years ago in the crystalline air of the Sangre de Cristos Mountains of New Mexico. Namely, the archer does not aim his arrow at Alpha Scorpionis, the heart star, but at Epsilon, lower in the torso. Observing the composites to learn astronomy is one thing, but at the same time, and quite spontaneously, the constellations trigger an act of imagination in which the graphic figures, parentheses, the zodiac cycle of animations, close parentheses, spring to life. I have found that the graphic and gestural actions suggested by these massive star patterns speak for themselves and seem to communicate things that cannot always be put into words. For instance, you will notice that the archer aims over the terminal star of the stinger, Upsilon, toward Epsilon in the torso. The faint star, Gamma, marks the tip of his arrow, so there is no mistaking the line of aim. The centaur armed with bow and arrow does not shoot for the heart of the scorpion, nor even the tail, where the poison is most concentrated and delivered. He aims for the lower trunk of the scorpion. What does such a gesture say? Note added for this reading. You GNE crew members may recall that in some briefing over the last couple of months, I spoke in a rather cursory manner, in a rather casual and offhanded manner, you could even say, about the scorpion mother delivering her venom to the human species. That would seem to be quite a significant event in the current course of our history, and yet I have not so far elaborated upon that event. Well, in the context of this celestial image, the archer aiming toward the trunk of the scorpion, I can specify exactly the moment when that venom was delivered based on the apogee-perigee navigation calendar. And I may be able to say a few words about the significance of that venom. Now, it is true that when you observe the constellation of the archer, pictured here in the essay, The Tablet of Destiny, you can trace the line of sight by four stars, and clearly the archer is not aiming upwards toward the heart star, Antares, but toward the star in the part of the trunk where the trunk is attached to the stinger, to the tail, the star Epsilon. I have mistakenly referred to this as the star Eta, Eta Scorpionis, and I made a joke about eating a scorpion. I like that joke. But unfortunately, it is not Eta Scorpionis, it is Epsilon Scorpionis. Well, you must try to imagine, we must not do anything that I say, but I invite you to try to imagine that the archer sights on the scorpion exactly in the way that a human archer sights. You bring down the bow on the target. So whenever I do target practice with my bow and arrow here in Spain, I set up some bales of hay toward one end of the driveway coming into my house. And then if I can find some poster of some sacred event showing Christ on the cross or some other figure of the crucified Savior, I generally stick that poster up. And, for instance, I would use the head of the crucified Savior for target practice. Bullseye would be right between the eyes. Or if it's an image of the crucifix, the crucifixion I'm using for target practice, then I'd like to get him right in the solar plexus, because a gut shot is particularly painful. And now when I do that, I draw the bow, I pull back the arrow, and when I do so, I'm pointing up and I draw down to sight on the bullseye, on the target. Likewise, you can imagine that the archer is drawing down. And so, consider the star Epsilon Scorpionis. Well, it has an ecliptic longitude of about 16 degrees. And that is the point where the sighting gesture of the archer becomes steady. But that is not the final point where the archer releases the arrow, because he draws down even further. He draws down to the equivalent of about 6 or 7 degrees of ecliptic longitude. So the point where the archer struck the scorpion was on the tail, actually on the tail. And you can interpret that as you like. You can say, well, maybe the archer struck the tail to knock off the tail of the scorpion, or to prevent the scorpion from flicking the tail. On the other hand, you could imagine that the strike of the archer's arrow upon the tail actually activated the flick of the tail through which Mother Scorpion released her poison. This is how I would advise you to imagine it, and the date upon which that cosmic event occurred would have been on November 6th, 2013. There was a perigee hit in 22 degrees of Sagittarius, which is equivalent to the stinger of the scorpion below the star Epsilon. That was the final hit, the final perigee event in the composite of the scorpion. And in that final perigee moment, I would identify the timing of the release of her venom, which is to say, the release of the venom of the planetary animal mother herself. So since the beginning of November 2013, her venom has been in some manner circulating in our world. It's interesting that the degree where the hit occurred, 22 Sagittarius, is very close, is only 2 degrees or less from 24 Sagittarius. And that is the exact longitude of the two stars that mark the stinger. Those stars are Ypsilon Sagittarii, which is called Lesat, and Lambda Sagittarii, or Lambda Scorpionis, excuse me. I'm confusing signs and constellations. Epsilon Scorpionis and Lambda Scorpionis, those are the Greek letters given to the two stars that vividly mark the exact stinger of the scorpion. They are unmistakable. They glitter. They are very close to each other. And you can sight them precisely in the night sky. So I remind you that the perigee surge of November 6, 2013 occurred when the archer drew down and shot right across the stinger into the tail of the scorpion. So what is the venom of the scorpion mother that was released at that time? Well, the planetary animal mother has been preparing this venom in the upper atmosphere since the beginning of reset. Preparation required extreme quiescence of the solar sunspot cycles during the 3 years of reset, which has been a fact. You will note that after November, going into December, and particularly into January of 2014, scientific observers noticed that the sunspot activity, which had been extraordinarily or anomalously low for a peak period, began to resume. And there were violent and remarkable sunspot eruptions in January of 2014 at the beginning of the Kali shift. But previous to that, there was a remarkable situation throughout 2011, 2012, and 2013. I don't know if any of you followed it on Suspicious Observers or any other site that provides this type of information. The fact is that sunspot activity was almost totally quiescent during those 3 years, even though it was supposed to be at a peak. And even more interestingly, when the solar eruptions did occur, they occurred offside on the sun. The emissions discharged to the right and left from the sun, and they avoided discharging directly in the direction of the Earth. This is a fact. I'm not making this up, you know. So you could say that during the 3 years of reset, the sun cooperated with the Earth for some reason. And I'm indicating to you that the planetary animal mother needed that cooperation in order to prepare her venom in the upper atmosphere, because she makes her venom from ozone. Okay? And the conditions of ozone would naturally be disturbed and rendered more turbulent and difficult to manage by the impact of solar coronal emissions, correct? Well, she had the time and the conditions to prepare her venom, which consists of derivatives of ozone. Now, what are derivatives of ozone? I don't have the faintest idea, because when I detected that the nature of her venom involved derivatives of ozone, it was the first time in my life that I had ever conceived there was such a thing. So you might go and investigate what are derivatives of ozone. These are, in some way, the material of her venom. Now, not to make this additional note too long, I would like to give you a few indications of the effects of her venom. You might consider that her venom is like a truth serum rather than a cloud of cyanide gas. Her venom is not designed to kill life on Earth, and certainly not designed to kill human animals en masse. If human animals en masse are killed in a kind of extinction event, that would be due to other geophysical and geochemical processes that are now underway, such as the release of methane into the atmosphere, and things of that sort. No, her venom is like a truth serum. remember? Sodium pentothal, I think, is the name of the chemical that was used, given by injection to spies to see if they would tell the truth. There are various other truth serums that have been used by the military down through the years. Well, the truth serum, or venom, of the planetary animal mother has some peculiar properties. One of the first properties is that it renders a large number of people. It affects different animals in different ways. So we are all now breathing this truth serum, these oxides, these derivatives of ozone. We're now all breathing them. Since November, we have been breathing them, and more than that even, taking them into our bodies by osmosis, by chemical absorption. We have been absorbing her venom. Now, it affects people in different ways. The great majority of human animals will be affected by this venom in such a way that it will neutralize them, both mentally and physically. It will neutralize their minds so that they don't care about anything one way or another. That is to say, it renders them who are already in a rather, in what may be called a state of zombification, it renders them complacent in their zombification. And it, in some respects, is a mercy-killing application because it is like an anesthetic. So it is a truth serum that operates in the larger number of human animals like an anesthetic for the living dead and the zombies, so that they will not react one way or another to any events that might harm them or frighten them. They will simply face those events in a dumb and oblivious state of acceptance. That being so, her venom reduces them to a state of passivity and complacency, which obviously minimizes their disposition to violence. So, the purpose of that effect of the venom is to minimize violence in the masses, okay, as a whole. However, there are some specimens of the human species who will react to this venom in a different manner. For them, it will truly be a truth venom, a truth serum. They will find that they have the capacity, they have a capacity of which they were not formally aware. They will find that they have a super normal clarity about what is right and wrong. They will begin to see right and wrong and all questions of morality and ethics with new eyes, suddenly in a new, brilliant, lucid, and startling manner. It is remarkable that she could compose a venom out of the atmospheric gases that would actually produce this effect in some human animals and the previously described effect in others, and it's the same venom. Or, to be more precise, there are gradations and nuances in the different derivatives of ozone. Go investigate it. And let me know what you find out, because I don't even know what the derivatives of ozone are, scientifically speaking. Now, the third effect, which is a particularly subtle and long-range effect, is also a benevolent effect. All three of these effects are benevolent. First, the anesthetic effect on the general populace. Second, the sharpening of clarity in some human animals. And third is the effect that it will have on the younger generations. That is to say, the human animals who are now perhaps under the age of 18, who were in 2013 18 years or younger, and the ones who are born from this point on. The effect it will have on these younger generations is to permeate their neurochemistry in such a manner that they will be easily programmable out of the archonic world system into which they're born. It's a terrible thing to see the condition of young minds today, isn't it? There are infants who cannot even walk, infants still in the crib, who are seen to be using touch system iPads and so forth and tablets. They are wired into the archonic system of IT and artificial intelligence as soon as they're born. And it might be thought that they're goners because the power of IT, the spell of the archons, is upon them. But no, that is not the case. Because one of the really subtle and long-range effects of her venom is that it renders the young minds and young brains of our species susceptible to be reprogrammed into her natural world and thereby extracted from the archontic matrix. So, that's a rather long excursion and a rather long note, but I took this opportunity to explain that comment about the venom of Mother Scorpion because I had left it hanging in the air during some briefing in the previous few months. You may note that I posted this essay, The Tablet of Destiny, in June 2007. So it was in that month, 7 years ago, that I posed the question regarding the Archer Scorpion tableau. What does such a gesture say? And well, there you go. Some 5 or 6 years later, in the course of the GNE, and almost 7 years later, in reference to these celestial pictures, I was able to describe what the gesture says. All right, to resume the written material. The Maya Codex Trocorticianus presents the stellar archetype of the scorpion, quote, the old goddess with the scorpion's tail, reference Hamlet's Mill, facing page 291. Although there are some references to a 13-figure Aztec zodiac in Mesoamerican lore, I have been unable to make a consistent match with Greco-Latin composites, but this one is certain. The benign Egyptian scorpion goddess Selket was associated with this constellation as well. R. H. Allen notes the alignment of Egyptian and Grecian temples to the scorpion, quote, at the autumnal equinox of 3700 to 3500 BC, end quote. These dates denote when the equinox enters the composite, some 400 or 500 years, about 7 degrees of precession before it aligns to Antares in the composite. It is tempting to link the gruesome Aztec obsession with human sacrifice with the scorpion, but I think this is a wrong direction to go. Nothing in the extant mythology of the Aztec custom of sacrifice and the presumed reasons for it points to this figure. It would appear that rites of human sacrifice among the Aztecs belonged to the age of Kali Yuga, but to its late phase and to a severe pathological decline. Such practices cannot be pinned definitively on Scorpion mythology. Perhaps, however, this constellation encodes some information about the hidden cause of those practices, a murky tale of intoxication and black magic. Scorpionic myth may indicate the morbid pathology behind human sacrifice, but not the practice itself. How about other clues to the Aztec complex and its possible resonance with society at the end of Kali Yuga? R. A. Williamson, The Living Sky, Living the Sky, The Cosmos of the American Indian, points out that the Sun Room at Hovenheap, an Anasazi ruin on the Colorado-Utah border, was aligned to observe the position of Antares at the moment of the winter solstice in 1250 CE. This is precisely the date of the arrival of the Aztecs in central Mexico, although some estimates put this event 3 centuries earlier, around 950 CE, a date which I prefer. The historical date attached to the Toltec culture hero Quetzalcoatl is 950 or so. If the Aztecs, or Chichimecs, dog people, later to be known as Mexica, moon people, did arrive as refugees in the Valley of Mexico as early as 950 CE, which I believe to be so, they did not rise to power until 3 centuries later, around 1250, the date indicated by Williamson, and numerous other scholars, I might add. The Hovenheap clue is intriguing. Many scholars hold that the Chichimecs were refugees from the southwestern Pueblo cultures where entire villages were abandoned in the 10th century. They may actually have been the Anasazi, the vanished ones, of the American Southwest who attempted to relocate in a more southern clime after a natural catastrophe, drought, or whatever, dot, dot, dot. And consider this. The date, 1250, signals the rise of the warrior class globally. Readers of my Alternative History of the Grail will recall that the culminating date of Arthurian chivalry and the Grail Quest was precisely around 1250 AD, when Tristan and Parzival were written. This was also the precise moment of the consolidation of the warrior class of samurai in far-off Japan. By 1200, Japanese military orders reigned all over feudal Japan, the mirror counterpart to the eagle and jaguar societies among the Aztecs at the precise same moment. The odd mix of lethal violence with high aestheticism among the Aztecs, flower wars, had its exact counterpart in feudal Japan. Miguel Leon Portilla, the one scholar who captures most intimately the spirit of Aztec society, translates Aztec poetry on the beauty and transience of life that could well have been written by a samurai about to commit seppuku, ritual suicide, or seppuku. In Mexico and Japan, at the same historical moment, arose two societies dominated by a warrior class whose members celebrated violent death and suicide, a scorpionic glorification of the death wish, if you will. But knighthood in the European West was not comparable, although it was contemporaneous. Perhaps it was not comparable because the Arthurian heroes were inspired by the regenerative power of the Grail rather than by the mystique of the Bleeding Lance. A society based on war and inspired by a supermundane conception of war is not so alien to the war-driven economics of the modern world. The apocalyptic visions of today's righteous warmongers echo the Aztec madness transposed into a Jewish, Christian, or Islamic guise. The great irony of the conquest of Mexico is that Cortes brought to the natives a salvationist religion comparable in every respect to the sacrificial warrior code and ritual cannibalism it displaced. In fact, Cortes' religion had a glorified sacrificial victim as its central figure, didn't it? whose body was eaten by the devotees. This parallel may go a long way to explaining why Christianity had a fatal, captivating effect upon a culture toxically enmeshed in human sacrifice. Quote, "Sacrifice was a mechanism, an inner logic of the universe, almost a god in itself. This concept permeated the whole of Aztec mythology, whether cosmogonic or otherwise. It was also the central preoccupation of the Aztec state." End quote. This is from Burr Cartwright Brundage, The Fifth Son. Additional note, I would attempt to show at some future time, in the context of Calico War Party matters, that there were two sides to the Aztec world, one of which is completely unknown to us. The side of the Aztecs, represented by the state religion of war and human sacrifice and cannibalism, was not all there was to the warrior code of the Aztecs. And it is a scenario, a narrative of history that is pervaded with lies and misdirection. So at some point, if I have the time and the luxury to do so, I would investigate what might be called the true and untold story of Aztec shamanism and the warrior mystique of ancient Mexico. To resume with the material. Double doom. There is an image of Moctezuma with Cortez and the Mexican woman Malinche interpreting for Cortez. This is from The Broken Spears by Miguel Leon Portilla. I wonder who will be able to delve more deeply into the historical enigma of the conquest of Mexico as 2012 approaches. I wonder also if the bizarre fate of the Aztecs may be reflected in the death wish of Western culture in the remaining years of the Kalpa. My own theory, for what it's worth, is that the Mexica were double doomed. First, because the nobles and chiefs who rigidly controlled that society were poisoned by chocoholism. And second, because the entire culture was jinxed by the Toltecs with the, quote, return myth, unquote, of Quetzalcoatl. About all this baffling business, I will have more to say at the end of this essay. To continue with our reflections on Antares as a signal of the end time, it may seem preposterous to assert that a scorpion has a heart. The expression is figurative, of course. I believe that anatomical dissection of the said arachnid will not reveal a warm beating organ. But at Dendera, the narrow rooms facing the sacred lake on the north side of the temple served as mamasi, maternity wards. Some of the initiates of Hathor were also midwives who specialized in birth and contraception. A small frieze in the wards shows a scorpion attending a woman who undergoes an operation with her legs spread. Imagine this. The venom of a scorpion could be concocted into an antiseptic analgesic gel to ease birth pains and protect both mother and child from puerperal fever, a form of septicemia that can be contracted after birth. Hygienic measures against puerperal fever only came into practice in Europe in 1847 through the work of Ignaz Semmelweis. Nothing like a little Egyptian folklore to whet the imagination. We have to go much deeper than anecdotal lore to understand what manner of mother love resides in the heart of the scorpion, but such insight might direct us wisely on the way into extinction. Poison power. In his fabulous trilogy on plants, potions, and herbcraft, Pharmacopoeia, Pharmacodynamis, and Pharmacognosis, published by Mercury House, San Francisco, 1995 to 2005, Entheobotanist and psychonaut Dale Pendel argues that, quote, the poison path, unquote, is central to our evolutionary adventure. Quote, that plant poisons resemble the chemicals of our own nervous system is not a coincidence. We selected each other, fought great battles on microbial slimes, traded partners and parasites in a primordial orgy. We become trackers, threading through a labyrinth of rocks, plasma, toxic saps, nucleic acids like a sexual differentiation, iron versus magnesium, chitin versus cellulose, tracking backwards. End quote. That is from Pharmacopoesis, page 11. Pendel observes, as I did in chapter 18 of Not in His Image, discussing the role of the divine scapegoat in victim-perpetrator bonding, that, quote, the pharmacon is both remedy and poison. We seek the primal poison, the root illness, end quote. It appears that the scorpion, a poisonous insect, is not the image or origin of, quote, the root illness, end quote, but the image of our psychosomatic propensity for both lethal and healing poisons. Is that why the archer does not aim for the heart of the scorpion? In one sense, the stellar archetype of the scorpion, taken as the prime indicator of Kali Yuga, points to the tremendous healing potential for humanity in this age. It also points to the extremes of addiction that our species can manifest. As anyone who has gone through recovery will tell you, you have to bottom out to discover and claim your true potential as a human being. Pendel proposes an alchemical work of transmutation using poisons for illumination and healing. This is in Pharmacodynamis, page 3. It is true that some psychoactive plants are poisonous, Datura and Belladonna, for instance. But the effect depends on the dose, and a potentially toxic plant such as Datura inoxia, Jimson weed, can be used to heal and induce visions when it is administered in the right way. As far as I know, a good many psychoactive plants are not poisonous at all, even in strong doses. Psilocybin mushrooms, for instance. But Pendel's emphasis on poison is sagacious and fits the modern situation, the endgame of poisoning and pollution being enacted under the sign of the scorpion. Consistent with Pendel's magnificent opus, I would suggest that the scorpion oversees our end-time experience, because having become toxified in so many ways, we need to understand how to invert the toxification process, beat addiction, heal ancient wounds, etc. The archer does not kill the scorpion with a heart shot. He leaves the stinger to deliver the fatal dose, or the healing dose, as it is measured out. Poisons That Heal by Eileen Nauman is a good complement to the Pendel trilogy. The author describes in detail the antidotes concocted from various plant and animal poisons. The theme of poison and antidote is purely scorpionic. As 2012 approaches, we are living out this theme on a global scale. One example, addiction to alcohol, tobacco, heroin, and a huge arsenal of prescription drugs is universal on the planet and has been for some time. But recently, we are beginning to understand how psychoactive plants such as the ayahuasca vine and iboga can cure these global addictions. Rehab clinics using sacred plants are springing up in many countries, especially in Europe. Mother Scorpion brings healing and generation in the basket of sacred plants offered by the 13 indigenous grandmothers, some of whom Joanna Harcourt Smith has interviewed for futureprimitive.org. Transspeciation. We are the animal species unique in its capacity to pollute and poison its own habitat. To do this, strange as it sounds, we do this, strange as it sounds, due to our belief systems. What we believe can be a threat to our very survival. I have analyzed this pathology at length in Not in His Image. What I would add here is yet another scorpionic twist. Mother Scorpion guards the path of rebirth. Quote, at the end of the Milky Way, where she receives the souls of the dead, and from her, represented as a mother with many breasts, at which children take suck, come the souls of the newborn. End quote. That's taken from Hamlet's Mill. This being so, we would do well to examine our beliefs about life after death to see if they are compatible with the mother's way, or if they compel us to other concepts of post-mortem survival, immortality of the soul guaranteed by the Father God through the death and resurrection of his Son, for instance. How does Mother Scorpion accomplish the rebirth of souls, and how does her way compare to a continuing existence in the afterlife promised by the Abrahamic Father God? I would suggest that her way is a regenerative recovery process, biopsychic and biomystical, an occult process in which she reworks the evolutionary capacities of the entire human species and reconfigures high-end potential in individual genetic endowments. In other words, she effectuates rebirth for the genomic potential of the species, but not for individual human beings possessed of single self-identity. Quote, the souls of the newborn, unquote, are recycled human potential, deathless capacities for renewing and extending the evolutionary experiment of Gaia's life process over the long term. In the Eleusinian mysteries, this act of transpersonal rebirthing was celebrated in the figure of the divine child, Iakos. Christianity departed from pagan religion by co-opting the divine child and turning it into a heaven-sent savior incarnated from beyond this world, rather than an image of the transpersonal potential of humanity rooted in its habitat. This error signals the messianic madness of the Piscean Age and represents, so far, the worst extrapolation of that madness. If we look for divinity in an extra-human realm, blind to the evolutionary endowment of our own species, we cannot possibly get through an extinction event. Gnostics taught not that we are divine in ourselves, but in our faculties. We each carry the superhuman potential of nous, divine intelligence. The scorpion, pictured as, quote, a mother with many breasts, unquote, resembles Diana of Ephesus and other images of the milky, substantial, organic light. Human potential is renewed by immersion in that light. This happens at physical death and also in the initiatory experience of ego death. I would suggest that if we could understand the process of transpersonal regeneration of human genomic potential, we would realize how Gaia brings selected species through an extinction event. This is perhaps the paramount knowledge to be won in the moment of opportunity offered by the 2012 end-time phenomenon. While this may appear to be a terribly obscure or arcane subject, extremely difficult to conceptualize, the key to Gaian transspeciation, as I will call it, is written clearly in the code of the stars, the Pegasus Square. We noted that the head of the Manitou figure in the zodiac is undefined by distinct stars. The composite of Aquarius is dim and shambolic. Scanning its upper region, you find it hard to visualize a head of any kind. Unable to fix on the suggestion of a form, the eyes wander to more distinct stars. Observing the composite of Aquarius, you will inevitably find your eyes shifting upward and to the left, where brighter stars entrain your gaze. This happens by itself, because the mind automatically seeks patterns formed by stars in an area that can be encompassed in one glance, without needing to shift your eyes. Therefore, the eyes shift automatically in search for such areas. Such an area is the Pegasus Square, above the constellation of the Fishes, to the left of Aquarius. The Manitou constellation. A splayed, L-shaped extension identifies the head of Pegasus, pictured in Greco-Latin star lore as a massive horse flying upside down. The illustration is from Skywatching by David Levy. The designers of the Dendera Zodiac chose to display the Pegasus Square in a prominent manner between the Fishes, with axis D running over the corner of it. I think that should be axis E. Scholars identify this detail as a representation of the Sumerian Tablet of Destiny, Liku, also the name for a standard measure in agricultural surveying. The tablet contains three scribble lines to suggest cuneiform writing. The detail in the Dendera Zodiac is shown here without the said axis indicated. Thus, if the script of the human experiment is encoded in the overall design of the Dendera Zodiac, as I claim, it is also specifically displayed by an image within a design. To read the skywriting is to trace the long-term patterns of human evolution, phylogenetic motifs. I maintain that the depiction of the tablet at Dendera indicates that a socially communicable method of decoding the zodiac becomes necessary and possible in the final centuries of Kali Yuga. The Tablet of Destiny is both read and written in the decisive moment when our species faces what scientists call the sixth extinction. Today we understand the evolutionary script of our species to be the human genome written in genetic code, the DNA-RNA complex. Is this what the Tablet of Destiny represents? And if so, how do we regard the code in terms of astronomical myth? Let's recall that visually the head of the inverted Pegasus merges with the undefined head of Aquarius, more correctly, the Manitou or Mesotes. This is the intermediary who preserves the interspecies bond and brings visionary wisdom. I propose that the Mesotes is an evolutionary guide of the kind encountered, sometimes as a power animal, in the vision quests of Native America. How does this indigenous theme relate to traditional material on Pegasus? In Greco-Latin sky lore, Pegasus was a winged horse that sprang from a magic spring. Recall that the Manitou Mesotes is often connected with water and its healing powers, and took flight toward Andromeda. In fact, the brightest star in the square, located at the upper left-hand corner, belongs to the constellation of Andromeda, as well, and marks the head star of the, quote, fallen woman of that myth. What? A fallen woman in the mix? Does this figure not bring to mind the fallen goddess Sophia? The starry plot thickens. This star is called Alpheratz, wrongly spelled Alpheretz in the document. Although it does not lie on the ecliptic where precession is measured, Alpheratz, like all stars, has an ecliptic alignment, and its position can be measured in ecliptic degrees, that is to say, on the rim, the calibrated rim, of the orbital plane of the Earth. Its ecliptic longitude in 2000 CE is 14.31 degrees. This means that at some time in the not-too-distant past, the spring equinox, VP, was aligned to Alpheratz. Using the rate of 71.632 degrees per annum, we multiply this figure by the current distance from the VP, 14.31 degrees, and get 1,025 years. Subtract this figure from 2000 CE, the epoch of the current longitude, and you get 975 CE. Well, this date is 7 years from 968 CE, which I suggested for the most probable date to associate with Parzival's attainment of the Grail, i.e., instruction by the organic light, the primary substance body of the fallen goddess, Sophia. To put it in mythographic lingo, the attainment of the Grail in medieval legend was timed to the VP's alignment with the head star of Andromeda, a cognate of the divine Sophia. Illustration of the great square of Pegasus, with the addition of the features attributed to the horse. Alpharetz is shown, also called Sira, correlating to the date 975 CE, and another star on the square, Algenib, correlated to 1344 CE. Common error. Era. Now we're on to something, because 975 CE falls in the time of the historical avatar of Quetzalcoatl, the Toltec prince Seacatl, said to have been born in 947 and to have undergone, like Christ, a voluntary sacrificial death about 50 years later. The Quetzalcoatl legend is a messianic tale of the Piscean Age that mixes historical and mythological elements, as does the legend of Jesus Christ, to whom Quetzalcoatl is often compared. This is fine and lovely for those who want to reconcile all the great religions into a single benign system. But the urgent question is, how do we actually live out such tales? Where do they take us when we adopt the beliefs encoded in them? Do we blindly buy into such myths, becoming filled with a sense of expectation they engender? Or do we look at them critically, asking how and if they elucidate our evolutionary path in any way, or lead us into a sane, sustainable, long-term trajectory for the human species? The above line drawing of Pegasus from Julius Stahl, The New Patterns in the Sky, shows clearly that Alpharetz, the head star of Andromeda, forms the upper left-hand corner of the Pegasus square. The composition of the stellar pictures, the result of deliberate visualization, links the record of human evolution, the tablet, to the figure of the fallen goddess. It is particularly revealing to apply the method of star timing to this configuration. We can read the square mythologically, but also in terms of historical events timed to the composite stars. Of the four stars in the square, Alpharetz and Algenib, or Algenib, which is below it, generate dates in time past, while Shiat and Markab generate dates in the far future. The dating of 965 CE for Alpharetz alerts us to the Parzival-Quetzalcoatl parallel in the 10th century, as just noted. It is a fortunate sign in the heavens, reminding us how humanity is guided by those who encounter the organic light, or misguided by black magical games and messianic pretenses. And there is another strong omen in the historical timing of the square. Algenib, Gamma Pegasi, has a longitude of 9.16 degrees for the year 2000. This converts to 1344 in historical time. Of the many events unfolding in that time, one comes forcefully to the front. In 1347, the Black Death, already ravaging parts of Asia, reached Messina, Italy, and rapidly spread both towards northwards into Europe and southwards toward Africa. The bubonic plague of the 1340s was one of the most devastating events of its kind in human history. It could, in what could be considered a mini-extinction event, it decimated one-third of the population of Europe. Whatever one thinks of stardating or of my mythological reading of the constellations, it is undeniable that the Tablet of Destiny generates these two dates, and hence juxtaposes two motifs illustrated by historical events. The Grail quest, our perennial connection with Sophia through the organic light, and mass extinction, the Black Death. I am not making up these events or juggling the calculations. I am simply placing the historical moments signaled by star dating in a narrative frame with the intention of learning what can be learned from such an exercise in creative mythology. Here I skip the section subtitled The Master Scam and continue reading in the section The Return Myth. There are actually two endings to the Quetzalcoatl story. In one, Xayat-Acatl immolates himself in a pyre and his heart ascends to heaven, turning into the morning star Venus. Here the plumed serpent triumphs in a transcendental act like Christ ascending into the clouds. But like Christ, Quetzalcoatl is a failed messiah. He has to die to complete his mission, and, well, quite frankly, we're never certain that he does complete it. We are left to rely on faith in a miraculous solution, a mysterious ending. Parzival's story, on the other hand, is about direct experience of a mystery that grounds and guides humanity through its entire course of evolution. In the second version of the Quetzalcoatl myth, after a humiliating defeat in a magical contest with the sorcerer Tezcatlipoca, the Christ-like Xayat-Acatl departs from the Toltecs and lives among the Maya, propounding the usual good guy message to them before sailing off to the east on a raft of serpents. Here the return myth comes into play. The prediction of Quetzalcoatl's return may have been attached to an historical event by Toltec seers, perhaps a war between two bands of shamans, and passed on to the Aztecs when they invaded and overthrew Toltec civilization between 950 and 1250 CE. I classify this return myth as an instance of the master scam used by the Toltec sages to ensure the downfall of the people who overthrew them. All messianic tales are examples of the master scam. But in this case, the plot seems to have been deliberately implanted in an enemy culture, whereas generally a whole culture or race will be converted to such a messianic belief system by another culture or race attempting to absorb or dominate it. Conversion to a messianic agenda usually profits the conquering race or culture, obviously, because messianism is always aligned with an agenda of perpetration and domination, not to mention genocide. But for the Aztecs, the adoption of this belief was their undoing and the end of their domination. Granted, it always takes a great deal of intimidation and physical coercion to get people to adopt such myths. Consider the history of Christianity in Europe. But I would guess that the Aztecs were largely tricked into adopting the return myth of Quetzalcoatl by the people they defeated, if indeed they did defeat the Toltecs. They were certainly not forced into it by another people who wished to conquer them. In the end, the myth itself conquered the people who adopted it. It worked like a post-hypnotic suggestion, causing the entire Aztec culture, and especially the ruling class, to collapse psychically when faced with the return of Quetzalcoatl in the guise of Cortez. This is unique and quite bizarre. But so is just about everything else we learn about the rise of the Aztecs and the conquest of Mexico by Cortez. As a mythologist, I maintain that the return of Quetzalcoatl was not mistaken by Moctezuma and his people. The coming of Cortez was the predicted return, the enactment of a curse planted in the Aztec mind by the superior savvy of the Toltecs. I should say, due to the enactment of a curse. I consider it mistaken to link the coming of Quetzalcoatl with the 2012 end time because that return has already happened. It's over and done, having been enacted in what is perhaps the most bizarre historical drama in human history, or at least in recent history. However, the 2012 end time may be the moment when we finally come to understand what did happen in the conquest of Mexico. People continue to look for a post-conquest return of the plumed serpent, or declare that it had already happened. One of the countless 2012 sites claims that Toltec and Maya prophecies of the return of Quetzalcoatl, quote, clearly foretell the coming of the Bab and the Bahula, the twin prophet founders of the Baha'i faith, end quote. According to Olin Karch, author of, quote, prophetic dates given by Toltecs and Aztecs, end quote, the first of 13 heavens began in 1168, an alternative date assigned to the historical avatar of Quetzalcoatl by Mayanist Herbert Spinden. The 13th era of 52 years computing from this date was 1844 to 1896, when Baha'i arose. This is yet more messianic hype for the master scam, a spiritual affliction of the Piscean Age. The Toltec seers were brilliant diviners and consummate magicians who perhaps saw through the delusion of messianic expectation along the lines I'm suggesting here. The predicted return of Quetzalcoatl involved a sacrificial religion of male warrior dominance that mirrored Aztec society down to its terrible, twisted core. You could say that Montezuma met his demonic counterpart in another warrior dedicated to the religion of dominance, Hernando Cortez. The expectation of Quetzalcoatl's return set the Aztec chief up for a game of powerlessness, despair, and confusion, easily won by his soi-disant Christian adversary. Somehow, the Toltec seers saw that the Aztecs would be defeated by a belief system uncannily similar to their, the Aztecs, own, or defeated by their own beliefs, transposed into a different frame, personified by different players. What a fantastic plot twist. Overwriting. The way I mix myth and history will not be to everyone's liking. Many will not want to go along with these Lashian fabulations. Fine, make up your own stories. Use star timing to plot them if you care to, or can. Elucidate the beliefs encoded in the narratives and plots you offer, and if you dare to be that transparent, if you dare. But bear in mind, whether or not you like my stories, they're not really mine. They are drawn from a repertoire of themes deposited in the human psyche over thousands of years of evolution. They are variants of the phylogenetic record, the indigenous narrative of humanity. Tablet of Destiny is an explicit image of the phylogenetic record. Reading it mythologically is one way to go. Reading it mythopoetically is another way to go. There are other ways to read it as well, but read it we must. Otherwise, how will the path through extinction and the way to transpeciation be discovered? In Hindu myth, Kali is a version of the supreme goddess, the Devi or Maya Shakti, who produces by her dreaming powers the sensorial worlds and the creaturely forms that inhabit them. In Notney's image, I have argued that the parallelism Shakti Gaya Sophia works because it fits our need to see Gaia in terms of the tantric vision of life. Tantrikas devoted to wild, ecstatic contact with the Gaian goddess of wisdom will also be on intimate terms with the devouring mother, the destroyer aspect of Sophia. The Aztecs knew her as Tizimitl, a bloody-mouthed demon of the night pictured with a necklace of beating hearts. It is easy to find such parallels, but not so easy to evaluate them. The Mashika did not seem to have struck a balance between Gaia Shakti as the nurturing planetary mother and Kali Shakti as the devouring mother. Images of female divinities are plentiful through the Aztec pantheon, but they do not add up to a coherent portrait of the Earth goddess, as far as I can tell. I suspect that the imagination of the Mexica had been occluded by black magical operations involving the imposition of a male warrior cult centered on Nanahuatl, the insatiable blood-drinking sun. This god, pictured with hideous separations, may well represent the sun marked by sunspots. The myth of Nanahuatl is anomalous and known to have been the invention of the sorcerer Tlacaelel. Tlakelel, close advisor on both war and magic to four emperors. He compelled his uncle, Iscoatl, to burn the sacred codices of the Toltecs and write the history of the Mexica to legitimate the male warrior mystique and solar heart sacrifice. See The Conquest of Mexico, U. Thomas, page 25. Before their books were burned by Christian missionaries who converted them to a different sacrifice cult, the Aztecs had burned the books of the Toltecs, which held their true history and origin. Mythological images and narratives in the phylogenetic record are often overwritten in this way, that is, by brutal suppression and cultural genocide, if not mental manipulation, lies, and threats. The psycho-spiritual drama of such actions is devastating for our species. The entire range of messianic myths represents overwriting of the indigenous record of a human-authored agenda. In sharing the Gaia mythos, I emphasize that genuine creative mythology, that is, directive myth, that can educate and guide our species in ways compatible with its true potential, has no author. The return myth of Quetzalcoatl was constructed by Toltec sages who, I would guess, understood the phylogenetic record in the way that shamans do in many cultures, namely in visionary trance induced by the ingestion of psychoactive plants. Tezcatlipoca read the record and also saw how to overwrite it and set up the Aztecs for a catastrophic plunge from power. This has to be one of the consummate feats of magical realism of all time. If the Toltecs could pull off that kind of myth-making to bring down a civilization, what myth might we conjure to create a new civilization? What I am attempting in these 2012 essays and elsewhere in this site is to decode the phylogenetic record, the mythological plot of human evolution. At the risk of sounding arrogant, I will say that I can do this because I have the tools and the training. Also, the time. The generic mythological record of humanity is complex and expansive. Even local and regional myth is extremely dense, demanding years of close scrutiny. Brundage identifies 8 cycles of Aztec myth, of which the Quetzalcoatl story is but one, and not even the most revealing. So, decoding myth takes time and dedication. It is no job for amateurs, but planetary myth-making is an open-source practice in which many people can participate. I would love to teach how to do this in real life, with the benefit of reception and collaboration from a community of people who interact with me directly in flesh and blood. But that currently is not the case, so I am teaching it as best I can in the sterile medium of cyberspace. The method of creative mythology, or dynamic mythology, as I prefer to call it sometimes, depends on going into the primordial images and reworking them in new language. Take the image of the eagle on the nopal tree, the nopal cactus, the central motif in the foundation myth of the Mexica. The remote ancestral peoples of that tribe were led by 5 supernatural beings, the Mixcoatls, cloud serpents, who came from the north. Anthropologically, this image may represent a culture of shamanic hunter warriors who crossed the Bering Straits during the Upper Paleolithic. In the Mixcoatl cycle, a long chain of magical events precedes the exodus of the Chichimecs toward the south. A narrative so vast that the legend of Quetzalcoatl seems almost a short, straggling footnote to it. When they arrive in the Valley of Mexico, they witness an omen. An eagle with a serpent in its beak alights upon a nopal cactus. At that exact spot, they founded the lacustrine city of Tenochtitlan, quote, the place near the nopal cactus, end quote. Illustration from the Codex Borgia, showing this picture, and that is taken from Brundage, the fifth son. What do you make of that picture, my fair-eyed friends? I would venture to say that you can't make much of it in an ordinary state of attention. Such mythological images are like icons in the phylogenetic memory bank. You can click on the icon forever and not get anywhere, as long as the right applications are not installed. Like Alice, you have to take the pill, the mind-altering substance that allows access to transpersonal psychogenetic material in its raw form. Do that, then contemplate this image, and see what non-ordinary insight comes to you about it. Overwriting is a huge problem in these investigations. Everywhere I look, the overwriting of the messianic plot mucks up our memory of the phylogenetic record. I expect a strong protest here along these lines. How can I claim that messianic imagery is not also from the indigenous record? That the themes of salvation and sacrifice are not as valid as anything else found in the vast bank of archetypal material produced by the human psyche? Well, I do say so. It's completely objectionable, by the way, to take this position in terms of Jungian archetypal psychology or the mythological investigation of the collective unconscious, blah, blah, blah. It will be difficult, if not impossible, for some people to accept that anything goes is not the rule for the directive myth of humanity. There is genuine indigenous myth, the outgrowth of our bond to the cosmos, nature, and all species, and there is overwriting, display of specious invention, malicious fabrication, imaginal skew, and to which I might add, the lying narrative imposed by the predators and psychopaths. Whoever cannot tell the difference is not qualified to comment on planetary mythmaking. If that's an objectionable stance, then so be it. I didn't take on this mission to win a popularity contest. Here, and I quote a couple of lines from Bob Dylan, Not Dark Yet. Finally, concluding paragraph. With the spring equinox sliding beneath the tablet of destiny since the 10th century, humanity has entered a time to learn to tell the difference between genuine phylogenetic myth and the official version of the human story foisted on the world by the authorities. I would not say that our future depends on making that distinction. Our future as a species depends on making the connection to Gaia Sophia. But I would say that the storytelling of our future and the chances of our intimate participation in Sophia's own story do depend, yes, in a most vivid way, upon that challenging and objectionable distinction. JLL, Andalusia, 23rd June, 2007.